Are we live? I
Yep.
think we're live. Oh, okay. Oh, we're live. Hey, welcome back to the MMA Prospectus. This is Zane Simon. I'm joined by Patrick Wyman and Tom Grant, as always. It's been an exciting and harrowing week for all three of us. I think at this point we're just about at the end of our tether, but we're here to discuss the prospect world. Yes. Wyman has given up already on the show and whatever we were going to talk about. So instead, we're just going to listen to 30 minutes of him complaining and grabbing his head, going like this.
Hey,
I think.
you know I'm the most giftable one of the crew, and you're just jealous of that. You hate me because you ain't me.
Yeah, it's true. You
Just
know, I've measured myself up to you, and I was found wanting. So. Instead,
yeah.
all you're getting is bitterness on this end.
Yup.
Crazy.
Nah, it's just long day. Already spent a lot of time recording stuff.
Yeah. And what we're going to look at today is we're going to look at the UFC on Fox 14 card tomorrow, which has a ton of young talent on it, a ton of fighters that we're excited about. And then maybe we're going to talk about just one last look at our featherweight scouting report and sort of a preview of our extra pieces for it. Talk about the fighters that didn't make the cut. Talk about, in case of Wyman, talk about how dumb we are for some of the guys we overlooked. And, just get into that a little bit more. And then maybe if we have time at the end of all this, take a look back at last week's Boston card and how the prospects on it performed overall. Not that great, so not a lot to talk about there, which is why it's last. Anyway, so to start out, I think with this card, there are like a few big names that we really want to cover, and then some guys that are maybe some of them might stick out, some of them might not. The first guys obviously are Irokin, Bektis, and Aliyev and Tumanov. Those are really the fight, I think, the four guys on this card that I'm really excited for. Tom, who are you excited for most?
I'm really excited to see Mirsad Bektik fight again. I'm really pumped to see him get back in the cage. I'm always down. I'm always down. Oh, I lost him for a Irokin fight, just because there's a high probability of someone hitting the canvas really hard in that. So probably those two fights I'm most jazzed for. But let's be honest, it's everyone's tuning in to watch Nikita Krylov.
It's true. It's so true.
That was such a great setup for that. Like, well played, Tom. Well played. I got to give you credit.
Pat, any?
I am most stoked about Mirsad Bektic. I think he is still one of the very best prospects on the face of the planet. I had a chance to talk with him last week. I talked with his head coach, Ricardo Laborio, today. He is. I mean, he's a physical specimen. He's just a monster physically, incredibly strong, incredibly explosive, incredibly fast. He's just got just ridiculous physical gifts. But he's also been born and raised in that environment at American Top Team. He's been training there since he was still an amateur. The story goes, the very first day he drove all the way from Nebraska down to South Florida, went straight to the gym. Walked in, and the first thing he did was jump in and start sparring with Mike Thomas Brown. Brown was getting ready, I think, to fight Nam Phan or Diego Nunez. And Bektic walked right in, got in there with him, and got clobbered by a Mike Brown overhand right in that sparring session. But I think that says a lot about who Mirsad Bektic is, where he comes from, and what kind of talent and potential he had. Everybody who's close to him talks about what a monstrous work ethic he has. Laborio talked about that a lot. Just how hard he works. Bektic talked when I spoke with him on the MMA rounds this week. Bektic talked about how he's had to work hard to kind of keep himself in check. That when he's surrounded by that kind of talent in that environment, it's a constant struggle to not overwork himself, because that's his natural tendency. But brutal top game, really explosive double leg. Really puts together nice combinations with his hands. And this looks to be a good matchup for him to kind of take the next step and showcase the improvements that he's made.
Yeah, and just an absolute beast in the clinch.
Yeah, I mean, he talks a lot about Georges St-Pierre and how Georges St-Pierre, I accidentally used the phrase when I was interviewing him, hero. Bektich was quick to tell me, no, Georges St-Pierre is not his hero. But he's somebody that he's very consciously modeled his game after. He's really big on phase shifting. He thinks a lot about transitions, about how he's going to cover his takedowns with strikes and vice versa. He takes a lot of inspiration from GSP's game over the years. And I don't think the comparison, frankly, is all that far off, except that Bektich, if anything, compared to where GSP was at an equivalent point, is maybe further along in terms of the development of his skills and has more in the way of natural power in his hands. But, you know, it's the fact that it's not like a laughable comparison, I think, says a lot about this kid's talent.
Yeah, it's definitely a fight I'm looking forward to. And I think, you know, it's a good matchup in Redmond in a fighter who, and especially on, you know, short notice and missing weight, probably sounds like he had not a great weight cut at all. I was hearing he cut like 33 pounds in 2 weeks for this fight. So at that point, it's probably, there's a good chance it'll be a showcase. I mean, Redmond's the kind of guy who I would say is probably a little more well-rounded right now in terms of just like how his overall game is together. Like, he actually has a pretty good style going, but he physically is not comparable. I think it's, you know, it's either Bektich by decision or TKO or Redmond by submission if he can kind of latch onto something Hail Mary. So
yeah, I mean, I
expect Bektich probably in this case by TKO, because he puts a really frenetic pace on people, and once he gets you down on the ground, he beats the snot out of people. And I mean, there's obviously, like, you know, regional MMA, we see a lot of things, but I think at least two of his fights that I watched, he finished opponents with ground and pound inside their own guard without having hurt them on the feet, which is not an insignificant thing to do because of how defensible the guard position is. And he's really good at just stuffing guys up against the cage and beating the snot out of them.
He's Bektich's specialty. When you watch him get a fight to the ground, the way his strength really comes through is in his posture in the guard. That he is almost impossible on your back, no matter how strong you are. I mean, Chaz Skelly is like a brutally strong dude himself, and Skelly couldn't control his posture. You know, Bektich has been inside the guards of some guys who have really good guards on the regional scene. The last guy he beat before he came to the UFC is a guy named I think it was Joe Pearson. And Pearson is one of these, you know, regional journeymen. I think he's got like 60 fights on his record, like 40 and 20 or something like that. But really, his specialty is guard grappling, and he's submitted guys, like solid prospects, off his back. He pulled guard on Bektich, and he was tapping to strikes in about 45 seconds after that.
Yeah, the triangular. Yes, he's actually like he's even a record holder in MMA, I believe.
Yeah, I think he has the most triangle choke finishes of anybody.
Yep.
So this is we're talking about a dude who has a lot of tricks up his sleeve in terms of how to control somebody from his back, and Bektich just blasted him. I mean, it was not for even a second competitive, and that's really what makes Bektich so special. You know, a lot of guys come into the UFC with a good top game. You know, that's a skill set that carries you a long way on the regional scene, is just the ability to work somebody over from top position. Rarely do you see somebody who is just going to blast the crap out of you within seconds of getting you down, because you just can't hold him. You know, you can't control his posture. You can't latch onto his head. It's impossible to control him with overhooks. Wrist control is essentially worthless. Like, I mean, it is a plus skill set. And the fact that he can blast W in the middle of the cage even without a setup, he sets up his takedowns well, but the fact that even in the middle of the cage, he can get in on your hips and showcase just a tremendous drive and explosiveness, it's awesome. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I'm sensing the Pat's like lukewarm on his prospects.
Oh, very lukewarm. Yeah, I'm done talking. I got nothing left for the day.
He was only your. He was your. And I think it's worth mentioning that when Pat was doing prospect work for Bloody Elbow, that he was his number one prospect for the Search for Future Champions series. So obviously, there's a lot of talent there. I know that for heavyweight, Zane and I, we really hadn't made like a full search yet of heavyweights, but Oh God, I'm blanking on his name. Orokin was one of the guys that we had tagged pretty early on as a guy that we absolutely had to look at.
Well, I would argue even to the point that I have scouted heavyweight, especially scouting, because scouting light heavyweight, a lot of what I went through to do that was to go out and look at tape on heavyweights and see which of these guys was going to drop down and which of these guys probably couldn't stay in the division of the top heavyweights out there, because, I mean, that's one of the ways you're going to get light heavyweight talent, really, at this point. And I would, as just a casual, not an in-depth scout, but I would say that Konstantin Orokin is number one of all the guys I've seen. I mean, there are some guys, I think, out there that could be competitive. I mean, I know there are guys like Tybura and some of the Polish and other Russian guys, but nobody who really compares for raw physicality and athletic ability. Like, just the athleticism is really the thing that I think he has easily head and shoulders over every other rising heavyweight in the world.
And I would agree. He's probably one of the better heavyweights at athletes at heavyweight that I've seen, and he already has some pretty big names on his resume in terms of heavyweight and light heavyweight wins. I mean, he beat Brett Rogers. He knocked out Sokaju. He just knocked out Dave Huckaba to get into the UFC. So he's got some names. He's been in there with some higher level dudes, and he's built like a fire hydrant. He's not a tall heavyweight, but you'd also be hard put to describe him as undersized for the division because he's about as broad as he is tall. Really strong in the clinch and good power even for heavyweight. He just puts guys out. I don't think he's a perfect fighter, and I don't think Zane, I don't think you would assert that either. But his movement isn't necessarily great, and he doesn't really throw much in the way of strikes. So I think he could get stuck kind of on the outside in fights and end up having fights in which kind of the whole fight goes by and suddenly like you kind of realize that not much really happened in, but he's going to connect some punches on guys in the UFC and they're just going to go to sleep.
Yeah. I got to say, I'm not quite that high on Orokin for exactly that reason, that he doesn't have a backup plan at all. Like his plan A is to bomb you with just some of the most brutal, ridiculous punches you've ever seen in your life. And chances are if he touches your chin, you're going to go out. But he has nothing in the way of a backup plan at all. So if you're content to kind of jab him or kick him from distance and kind of circle and avoid and stay away from his right hand, he doesn't have a way of dealing with that. You know, like he doesn't really have another way of getting after you. You know, he does have a lot of setups. Once you're in his range, he's got a lot of options for you. You know, he'll work the body a little bit. He'll throw the occasional low kick. He can throw both moving forward and on the counter, but he doesn't really have stalking footwork. He's not really the kind of guy who's going to push you towards the ropes or towards the fence and try and cut off your angles. That's not really his game. He doesn't have the really kind of defined footwork to cut off your angles, and try and herd you into his shots. But if you stray into his wheelhouse, he will put you to sleep. So I think the other piece of this, and the other reason I'm not quite as high, is because when you're looking at one of the big differences between guys in the UFC and guys outside of it, one of the big factors in that is just durability. Just can you take a shot? And guys in the UFC, they may not be any more skilled necessarily than guys outside of it, but they are a lot better able to take a shot. They can eat those, and so I'm wondering when we put Orokin in there against the kind of competition he'll fight in the UFC, if there are going to be guys who just shrug off his punches and outland him to a comfortable 3-round decision.
Yeah, I guess my only thing that I would say to that is, first of all, it's heavyweight, and so backup plans and footwork are like a distant imaginary thing to 99% of that division. And, you know, given his relative inexperience in terms of how long his career is, I mean, I think he's only been fighting for like 2 years as a pro, though there's a lot of time for that to develop against you know, while facing the Victor Pestas and, you know, or even Derek Lewis's of the world. Like, there are plenty of guys in the UFC who are just going to try and walk at him and bomb him and hope that that works for them.
I was going to say, I was just going to throw out some names, because it's one of those things where even with his flaws, I think it's pretty easy for him to exist in the top, like, half of the heavyweight division, because Rudan Potts, well, Walt Harris, Soa Pulele.
Soa beats Arohin at this point.
I'm not Soa sure about that.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, he beats him if he can wrestle him to the ground.
I mean, yeah. I absolutely think there are guys in the UFC in the heavyweight division who could make his life difficult and easily outpoint him. But there are plenty of guys in the UFC who will be more than happy to play his game in the division. I mean, and there's more than a couple guys in the heavyweight division that. At this point, I can see him easily existing in the middle of the heavyweight division, and if he adds to his game, he could potentially move up. But he's also, he hasn't been professionally speaking, he's only been fighting for, what, 2 years? Three years? And obviously he's 33, so there's that, but I think there's...
Heavyweight, these things aren't that important.
Yeah, at heavyweight thing, I mean, we just had two guys who fought in Pride fight for the interim heavyweight belt, so, I mean...
Krokop's back.
Krokop's back in the UFC. It's a weird division.
Yeah, I wouldn't go so far as to say the man's back. I mean, he will be fighting in the UFC.
He is present again.
physically.
I'm saying that... You know, when talking about a prospect at heavyweight, like, I think it's fair to say that it just doesn't work like the rest of MMA. It doesn't. And I'm at the point with the Rakim where I'm excited enough, I'll say this, that I will want to see somebody outpoint him before I believe that somebody's going to outpoint him.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, he may have that kind of special, ridiculous, like, I can land one shot for every three of yours, and I'm still going to win a decision because it's just that clear that my punches are harder than yours. I just think that that's a real problem for most guys on that level.
I think he'll have a problem moving into the elite divisions with that, but, I mean, again, to go back.
But the elite is top five in that division. I mean, really. It's a huge drop off. Anyway.
Yeah, no, I would agree with that. I mean, it's if you're an athlete and you have, as Zane said, if you're an athlete and you have plan A that works fairly well, you can exist in the UFC heavyweight division and do pretty well.
Yeah, I think it's fine to be tempered in expectations, and you know, anything can happen in the sport, and maybe he won't take off the way I think he will, but I do think that in that division, it's wise to, you know, be realistic that a lot of the guys that are, you know, that even do fairly well and stick around, I mean, guys are just incredibly limited, you know.
Yeah, I don't think there's any question about that.
So next up, we got two guys, both of which I think could have a very good future at welterweight. I mean, one of which we've already seen almost certainly does, and the other, it's a little like this will be kind of a show for him to see what he can do. But that's Albert Tumanov and Sultan Aliyev. Aliyev has done really well regionally. When he's on the regional circuit, he's like a stone cold killer. But his Bellator career was very blanket-like. If that's his UFC career, I think there's, like, he's got a very real ceiling.
Yeah, I think Aliyev's main strength is he's a really, really good takedown artist. He's got pretty good shots on the legs, and he's got good chain wrestling. He works really well in the clinch. He really, really likes trips from, like, kind of a stand-up clinch. He stands you up in the clinch, and then he starts working outside-inside trip combinations and gets you down. But on the ground, he identifies himself as kind of a ground-and-pound guy, but his ground game is is very reminiscent of, like, it's the problem that freestyle wrestlers, international freestyle wrestlers, have in MMA. They're not really that experienced with holding guys down. They're used to getting guys down, and then he carries his hips very, very high on the ground, and he's used to trying to control people who are actively trying not to be put on their back. And when guys are happy to kind of sit back and play guard, he has problems operating in guard, and he gives guys tons of space to move and get back up. So a lot of his fights kind of end up being takedown, a couple, like 30 seconds to a minute of groundwork. They stand back up and then rinse and repeat, shoot in, clinch, trip, and then a couple punches, stand up, shoot in, clinch, trip. And I think that kind of has a ceiling. And if he kind of fills that in, I think he could be successful, but he's got to fill in that ground game.
I mean, I picked Aliyev in this fight, and I do think he'll win because, you know, Kenny Robertson is a lot of things, but he's not an awesome athlete. And Aliyev does have these big technical flaws in his game. You know, like, I think you're absolutely right to point to his top game as being somewhat underwhelming, and more underwhelming than you would expect for a guy with his kind of Sambo background. And actually, this doesn't appear on his actual MMA record, but he did just get absolutely brutally leg locked in kind of a mixed rules Sambo match back in September. It doesn't count as an official loss, but, like, you know, Kenny Robertson is absolutely a guy who's gonna try and rip your leg off if you just leave it out there for him. So that's a concern for Aliyev in this fight, and he does have a lot of room to grow. But it's worth noting that he was really raw when he was in Bellator.
Like, yeah, he was really raw.
And he's got that loss to Doug Marshall on his record. He didn't lose that fight. No. Like, he didn't do much, but Marshall did nothing to deserve winning that fight. He just kind of laid on his back, and, you know, it was like, well, I prefer the guy on the bottom's inactivity to the guy on top's inactivity. and it was just a brutally terrible fight. But, like, do not, under any circumstances, do yourself the disservice of wasting 15 minutes watching it. But I'm not sold on him having a ton of long-term potential. I do think he's kind of an interesting fighter because the physical gifts are there. He's a good athlete. He really does have a strong clinch game. I think Tom is absolutely right to point out the work he does with kind of inside-outside trip combinations. He's definitely a throwing kind of Sambo guy. Like, that's very clear his wheelhouse. And the striking is kind of secondary. It looks a little awkward. A lot of what Tom calls Sambo strikes. You know, kind of single shots with a lot behind them and not much in the way of craft there. He is interesting. I mean, I think that, you know, if he's with the right coaches, he could improve and be kind of like a top 20, top 25-ish welterweight. But it's an interesting fight. And Robertson just does not get enough credit as being a fun, interesting fighter to watch.
I love watching Kenny Robertson, so I'm really gonna enjoy this fight no matter who wins. It's just one of those things that, like, Aliyev, you know, with holes in his game, I think he's one of those guys that's just like, he's the level of athlete that most fighters in the UFC just don't beat. Like, even in the UFC, you know, he may not be top 15, but it's like Eric Silva. Like, Eric Silva may never be a top 15 fighter with any consistency, but his level of athletic skill means that 80% of the division is just never going to touch him.
Yeah, absolutely.
And because I love this kind of, like, delineation and stuff, I like that Pat brought up the idea that he is a throwing Sambo guy, because I think a lot of, like, MMA fans in general are starting to become familiar with, like, kind of the sub styles of Sambo, and there are lots of guys who compete in combat Sambo and in sport Sambo whose primary way of winning matches is accumulating points through takedowns and then not really doing much else. And there are, and it's a sport where you can get around having not much of a ground game. And I think that's kind of the background he's coming from. Because, like, also the idea that, oh, all Sambo guys have wicked leg locks. Not really. There are plenty of Sambo guys that have basically no leg lock game. And so I think that's kind of where he's coming from. And it's kind of like with Khabib Nurmagomedov, where his game, I mean, is pretty much takedown, make them work to stand up, and then repeat. And he just has so much cardio and takedown ability that you can't really stop it. And I think he just has like a slightly lesser version of that game.
Well, even more Hobby Lobby. I mean, you know, that would be the real comparison. Is Hobolov is just a takedown artist, and that's almost his entire game. But that leads us to the final big prospect. There are a lot of prospects on this card, quite frankly. But the big name I really want to get to, and that's Albert Tumanov. And I'm honestly like, I feel like he's going to be in the top 10 before long. Unless the wheels just fall off the cart and he totally does not understand development and, like, keep up with my counter wrestling, make sure I work on my cardio. Unless, like, those are just things that he's like, yeah, fuck it, I can kick people. Like, he should be headed for the top 10.
I seem to recall that Albert Tumanov was the first guy that Tom got really excited about prospect-wise. Like, I remember before he made his UFC debut, Tom, you were watching film of him, and you're like, this guy is awesome! Like, and there were eyes bugging out of your head at, like, some of the things that he was doing.
And then Alcantara split-decisioned him.
Ildemar Alcantara, that dude, he's, like, the second biggest welterweight I've ever seen. Like, yeah,
he's a middleweight now.
Oh, yeah, there's no way he could keep making that cut. Like, he must walk around at 210, 215 pounds. Like, the dude's insanely low. The only guy I can think of off the top of my head who's bigger is, like, Seth Pazinski, and that's it.
And I was talking about this the other day, but Tumanov, I think, and this is one of those things where it's like, this is something he needs to work on. His counter wrestling isn't bad. He's actually a pretty decent counter wrestler. But if he gets taken down, he kind of goes like, he doesn't have this like, oh, and here's how I'm going to artfully and easily stand back up. It's like, oh shit, scramble, 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 scramble. I'm going to get up. And he just burns a shitload of energy.
Yeah.
And then suddenly, like we saw in that fight, he basically dominated Alcantara for like the first 4 minutes of that fight. And then suddenly all of his gas tank is gone and he's just in survival mode the rest of the way.
And more concerning in that fight was that he showed like a lack of some fundamentals from like a bottom game. I remember being very concerned from that fight that it was like he didn't know swim for underhook from like the half guard to then work to start to stand up. Like that was as basic as it gets from the half guard, and Alcantara just like quite literally started putting himself back in half guard because he realized that Tumanov was a great scrambler, but if he let him have half guard, that it shut down his scramble game and then he had no way to get up from there. And so that to me will be, I mean, he's training at K-Dojo still, right? So that's a pretty good grappling school. I have a feeling we're going to see some improvement on that front, but I'm not sold on him on being like on the upper levels of welterweight until, because you're going to have to be able to like technically get back up from being taken down if you want to fight serious welterweights.
Yeah. And in fairness to Tumanov, we've seen guys get to the very highest levels of mixed martial arts without knowing how to escape from half guard. Like, the Cub Swanson, Frankie Edgar, was a clinic in how to not defend yourself from half guard. Like, you know, on the part of Mr. Swanson there.
Yeah, I mean, Tumanov could get enough of the right matchups to make it all the way. And this is why I say, too, to me, it's like, unless he doesn't have any idea of what the problem is, he should be able to get pretty far.
Yeah, and he's gonna wreck people on the feet. I mean, he's gonna crush people if he keeps things standing up.
It's interesting. You know, we talk about different divisions as having kind of different strengths and weaknesses, and you know, lightweight is just packed with awesome strikers, but it doesn't have a lot in the way of really strong, powerful wrestlers. Whereas welterweight is very much the opposite. Welterweight at every tier of the welterweight division is stacked with guys who are gonna take you down. Every single tier of it is just packed with like wrestle grapplers who can strike a little bit, but they're not like, you know, they're nothing special on that front. And Tumanov, part of the reason that the Tumanov ceiling in that division is so high, if he gets those technical flaws fixed, is because there aren't a whole lot of guys who could stand up with him in his elite skill set and live to tell the tale. You know, like he's just a brutally powerful puncher. His left hook is ridiculous. He's got tremendous instincts for landing his high kicks. And unlike a lot of guys who throw the kind of sneaky karate-style high kicks that he does, Tumanov is going to put you to sleep with those.
Yeah.
Like, you know, like Ruslan Magomedov throws a similar kind of high kick game out there, but he really doesn't kick that hard. You know, Rashid Magomedov is another guy who throws those kinds of kicks. And again, they're powerful, but they're not like put you to sleep powerful. Kumanov is going to knock you, it is going to separate you from consciousness in a heartbeat if you get hit with a head kick.
Yeah.
I just hope that like 2 years from now, we see Brandon Thatch versus Albert Tumanov in a number one contender's bout. Like,
yeah.
That would be that. Like, that's all I want is just give them both time to climb, and then that fight.
You just say Thatch, and I'm so pumped that we're gonna see him back in the cage in like 2 weeks or 3 weeks or whatever it is. Like, I'm so excited that we're getting him back.
So will Brandon Thatch be the first guy that we're talking about, both as a prospect and as somebody who's fighting in a main event? Because I'm sure we'll talk about him on this show, right? Because he's only had two fights in the UFC.
Yeah, we will be definitely talking about him, and I think he might be the first guy that we talk about in that way.
It's nuts that he's fighting in a main event, but like it's also nuts how good he is, and he's only had two UFC fights. Like,
yeah, he's really good.
Yeah.
I guess the next question is, are there anybody, you know, there are a number of other fighters on this. There's Anthony Christodoulou, there's Makwan Amirkani, there's Chris Beal, there's Victor Pesta and Paul Redmond. Anybody that, like, really stands out to anyone?
Personally, I'm looking forward to Amirkani because, number one, he's the man who tapped out, yeah, I know, I butchered his name, whatever. He's the man who tapped out Duke and Wah, and I just really enjoy his game because I feel like he's like that. I think most submission or grappling gyms have a dude like him who just roll for submissions, and like if you roll with him 20 times, like, you know, you can control the heck out of him like 17 times, and then 2 times he'll catch you in a submission, and 1 time you might submit him. But, like, the 2 submissions he gets you in are just, like, nuts. Like, in a scramble and just snatches it up. So I'm kind of looking forward to him getting in there with Andy Ogle, because I think Ogle is just in, like, just at that level that he might win, but it also might be a lot of fun to watch.
You know who Amir Khani reminds me of? And this is going to sound like a weird comparison, but bear with me for a second. Remember when we were talking about Paige Van Zandt and how, like, spazzy her striking game looked? Like, you know, like all respect to Van Zandt, who since then has developed really enormous strides, but her striking game for a long time looked really like spazzy and jerky and weird. That's what Amirkhani's grappling game looks like. It's really spazzy and weird, and he goes for strange things, and he puts himself in these really like oddball like positions that Eddie Bravo couldn't come up with, no matter how fucking stoned he was. Like, it's really kind of a bizarre game, and like, It's fun to watch because he really could like submit anybody in any given fight, and then on the other hand, most of the time he's just going to look horrible and get ground down by guys who are technical enough to like recognize to like pick up on his next spazzy move before he does it. But to answer your question, other guys that I think are worth talking about, I think Redmond is probably worth discussing. He's got a nice little game for himself. You know, he specializes in the toe hold, which is a weird submission. We don't see that very much. But he's got a lot of different setups for it. It's interesting. He's really put together a nice little aggressive counterboxing game. He's one of these dudes who likes to move to the edge of the pocket, draw out your response, and then come back with like 3 or 4 punches of his own. I think like kind of a poor man's Ross Pearson without the defensive savvy. It's an interesting game. It's basic, but it really works well for him. He's really defined in his pressure. It's not going to help him against Bektic because Bektic is going to draw out that response and then duck under and take him down probably. But it's an interesting game. It's coming along nicely. He's made real technical strides, and I think he'll stick around the UFC for a while.
Yeah, I definitely like Redmond. I think the big thing was really that he's been able to pick up his volume and sharpen his combination striking to the point that volume isn't just like I'm diving in with 1 or 2 strikes, but it's that, you know, now he's diving in with 1 or 2 strikes, like we say, pulling back, drawing out the response, and then coming in with 2 or 3 more that are actually pretty sharp and on point and reasonably decent. And you know, yeah, maybe he's not going to hang with Bektik, but, or, you know, he could easily pick up wins in the rest of that division.
He's actually got a lot in common with, and I'm fairly sure they're teammates, so this would make sense. His boxing game is a lot like Neil Series is.
They are teammates, yeah.
And they share a lot of similarities in terms of their approach. They throw from kind of odd angles, but it works. It looks a little bit janky the first time you watch it, and then you realize, oh, they're actually putting a substantial volume of leather on target. It's kind of an interesting approach that they've got. It doesn't really look like what we would think of as really pure kind of boxing. It looks a little more loopy, and the punches are coming from strange places. But it's interesting. It's a cool kind of game that they've got.
Yeah. And otherwise, I'm frankly not that interested in Krista Dulu or Beal there.
Krista Dulu is legit terrible, man. He is really, really not good at fighting. Like, if Aishimov doesn't take him apart inside a round, he should lose his roster spot.
Yeah, Krista Dulu's... The thing is, he's a top control grappler who's dependent on opponent mistakes to get to the fight to the ground.
Yeah.
Like, that's it. And that's a tough, like, that's an impossible road to hoe if you're trying to be an elite fighter.
Like, please tell me you've seen his, like, self-put-together highlight video.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. it involves all of these weird jump cuts and things that are designed to make him look, like, not nearly as bad as he actually is. I mean, you know, I feel bad that we're talking about him like this, but the dude is really not good. And when I was looking for a film of him for my preview, I actually thought he was the other guy in one of these videos, the first one I watched, because the other guy just, like, he didn't look great, but he looked better. And I'm like, wait, you're telling me the other guy wins this fight? I got, like, 6 minutes into it, and I'm like, you've got to be kidding me. Like, how did this dude win here? Like, it just didn't make sense to me. So,
Was this his fight in Thailand, in, like, Asia?
I think it probably was. I can't remember which one, but I remember thinking, like, wow, this dude isn't too bad. And then, like, wait, what?
Oh, that's not, yeah. I have definitely done that when you're looking for a guy and he, like, changes hairstyles on you or something, and you're like, wow, he looks great, but totally different. Oh, that's not him. That's not him.
Yeah, this actually happens. I think this happens to all of us fairly often when you're looking at guys who don't have pictures on their Sherdog pages and you don't know what they look like. Like, it happens all the time. Yeah. All the time.
Like, where did that kicking game come from? That I don't remember that at all. Oh, he just got... Oh, okay, I see it now.
Yeah, there we go.
Otherwise, I will say this. I don't think Pest is going to beat Arakin. I don't think he has many chances to, other than perhaps just hooking up, being able to keep him in the clinch long enough to institute his ground game, but it just doesn't seem like a likely route.
I can see him coming off looking like a poor man's Phil Davis at range, trying to kick with him at distance, but Pesta doesn't really kick very hard, and
It's one of these weird things where I watch tape on him, and it's almost like magic where the moment he actually touches somebody and, like, gets a grip on them, he is, like, five times the fighter that he is when he's on the outside trying to strike. It's like suddenly all of his hooks and his dirty boxing just, like, tightens up instantly. And you can even see it in his fight with Magomedov, where it was, like, he was getting picked apart and beat up the whole fight, and then 1 minute he got, like, clinched up with him and landed a huge knee. He was like, oh, where did that come from? Out of nowhere. And then he was back to getting his ass kicked. And I mean, he's got promise, but it's definitely, like, he is a fighter I want to talk about because he's 24 and he's only, you know, he's been fighting for a little while now, but at heavyweight, I feel like he could have a future, but it's going to be tough for him getting these two matchups. I hope that they can throw him, you know, somebody like Walter, what's his name?
Walt Harris?
Walt Harris, yeah.
Yeah, it would be nice. I do hope they give him a chance to stick around, just because he's definitely better than a lot of these dudes that the UFC has been signing recently. Like, he's definitely better than Anthony Hamilton. Like, is there any question in your mind, like, if they put him in there with Anthony Hamilton, he'd win that fight or ruin Potts? Still never going to let you forget about picking Ruin Pots.
I know. I did it twice, for fuck's sake. Timothy Johnson.
You did it twice?
Yeah. Hamilton.
Wow. Oh, okay. Hamilton and Potts. That's a damned if you do and damned if you don't situation. Because either way, you come away having picked one of those two in a UFC fight.
Quick question. It's totally off topic, but is Hamilton Potts the worst fight of 2014?
Is it the worst fight ever?
In the UFC. Worst match.
We had Royston Weed, Dave Galera. That was a fight that...
Why do you make me remember these things?
Remembering that just was like, put you both into like the scene in Clockwork Orange where the eyes are pried open. It's like...
First fight pass card too, wasn't that like it's never gonna leave my consciousness because it was like the first fight pass card, and that's the first thing I think of when I think of that card. Wasn't Anton like pumping? Who was he like totally getting behind in that fight?
No, I think he was giving Galera some love for being like Filipino. But
something like that.
It was miserable. Anyway, that we've covered UFC on Fox, given ourselves a brief interlude into the vortex of hell that is some of the worst fights of the last year. Let's talk a little bit about the 2014 scouting report a little, or 2015 scouting report a little, because that is good times and fun. As we know, we did our last show highlighting all our picks and talking about them and what brought us there and all that. And now that you've had a week to ruminate on it, and I know you have, Patrick, I want to hear, you know, where did we go wrong?
Yeah, I mean, I think that there are three fighters that I would have talked about that did not appear in your top 10. And, you know, to some extent, this is just a difference of it's a difference in emphasis in the things that you and you guys think are important and that I do. And I think that's natural, and I think that's okay. Now, with that said, Herbert Burns should have been on your list. He's the brother of Gilbert Burns, who's a UFC lightweight, trained with the Black Zillions, is a really, really excellent fighter. So I think Herbert Burns should have been on your list. Really, really talented grappler. Really fantastic in transition.
Tom's fault. I liked Burns. I thought he was good, but Tom was all shitting on him.
What?
And I didn't actually realize that he was brothers with Gilbert Burns. I thought he might have been, but I also thought that would just be too strange to be Brazilian, and name your kids like Herbert and Gilbert. Like
they look exactly alike.
I haven't taken enough time to put them next to each other. So,
they're not at all the same fighter. You know, they really fight a lot differently. Herbert is probably not the athlete that Gilbert is. He's still a plus athlete, but you know, Gilbert is in a special class of his own. But he is a really opportunistic grappler. He finds a lot of his specialty is taking the back. He finds a lot of ways to get there. Really has some outstanding, very fast back takes. Has fought against pretty good competition in 1FC on his way up. Trains at Evolve. Spends a lot of time there. And I think his game will translate very well to American competition. Should he make that leap? I think he's a tremendously talented guy with a lot of upside. And again, he's only 26. He's got a lot of room. He's got a lot of room yet to grow. The other guy I like a lot is Levon Makashvili. He's a Georgian immigrant to the United States. He's got a very strong wrestling game. He's got a strong striking game. He doesn't throw as much as he might, but I think a lot of that has to do with inexperience. He's currently fighting in the Cage Fury organization. He's their featherweight champ. He beat Alexandre Bezeja, Bellator veteran, after losing to him the first time they fought back in August. I think I mean, I think he's going places. The Cage Fury has now a pretty long and exalted track record of sending prospects to the UFC. They've really matched them up nicely. That's something I place a lot of emphasis on. I want to know that guys have been good competition, and Makhachevili and Burns really have. They've beaten good competition. They've been in there with tough guys. They've been put in bad positions before, and they've come back from it. The final guy, and this is somebody that Tom and I talked about a little bit, I kind of backed off it, and now I'm coming back, is Arnold Allen, who fights in Cage Warriors. I really think Allen has a lot of potential. He's only 21 years old. He's got a really brutal top game, a really good clinch game, and he's shown improved striking over his last couple of matchups. He has never gotten a softball in terms of a matchup. He's really got a lot of experience that served him well. Is reportedly looking to train with bigger camps. Has really taken himself out of his comfort zone. I think he's a guy with a lot of potential. Now, those are my three. I would have had them on my lists. I think I probably would have had Burns, especially. I would have had him not just on a featherweight list, but on a broader list in general. I would have had him pretty high.
So I think. I mean, I was the one who was not as high on Burns as Zane was. I would contend the fact that I shit all over him. But,
hey, don't try to rewrite history, Tom. That's
No, I think Burns is quite good. My biggest thing is I want to, number one, the guys he was fighting. I mean, he faced some good competition. I wasn't super impressed. I mean, his entire game is predicated on getting to the ground, and obviously Herbert's a very good grappler, but I don't think his full grappling game has, like, completely transitioned to MMA yet. He's good at taking the back. He's also fought guys who, I mean, some of those guys were just absolutely giving it up in the terms of some of the guys I was watching against, I'm not super sold on the level of grappling he was going up against. I think he's a really good athlete. He really, really goes for stuff. He kind of reminds me, and kind of my like go-to comparison is like a Charles Oliveira type. Like really, really goes for it on the ground, and I think that could end up costing him later. But I don't disagree that he's going to be a pretty darn good fighter. And I'm also the one between the two of us who took the first look at Arnold Allen, and he was kind of like right on the cusp for me. My biggest thing for him is I think getting with a big camp is a really good thing for him because I really like his fighting style. I think he's wonderfully technical in the clinch. The one thing that made me kind of pump the brakes on him, I'm putting him in the top 10 at least this year, was his lone loss, which came to a Polish fighter whose last name I won't butcher.
Roszak, I think.
Yeah, Marcin Roszak. Who basically has the same style as Allen and is simply older and has his man strength, and that kind of shut down a lot of Allen's game. And I think as he develops physically, we'll see if he adds that strength to his game. I think he could be a perfectly functional, like top 10 fighter in kind of the vein of like a Nick Lentz if that happens.
I guess one of the things I want to talk about, I guess I have a couple of guys I'd like to touch on that didn't make our lists. Because, you know, I'm not disagreeing. I think Makhachevili especially and Burns, to me, we had this, like, five-way tie for 10th place.
Yeah.
And it eventually went to the guy that we felt had the most athletic upside and the most unchecked aggression. That was kind of, that ended up being our deciding factor. Which was Anzor Aziev, but, you know, that's all. A couple of other guys that were, you know, on my list of just barely missing out on that top spot that should be watched out for were, first of all, Alexander Pettersson, who's a bit more in the sort of Hussein Askabov mode of being super, super young, has, you know, only been fighting for a year and a half, is 21, six pro fights is probably a little small right now for the division, but could easily pick it up and do much better things, has some reasonably technical striking, isn't poor anywhere, very aggressive, young kid. And then another guy to watch out for, and he was too old to make our report, was Oleg Borisov. And, you know, he's been fighting for 3 years, he's 31, but he's one of those fighters that if he were, like, 25, I would be going, like, oh, my God, he's the next, like, dude is just all fast twitch muscle and power wrestling and power and power. Yeah. And he's a fighter that, you know, everybody should be looking out for because he'll be a lot of fun to watch when he gets to the next level.
And the easy and immediate comparison is like a Yoel Romero, which is old, but old for like being a prospect, but holy crap, can he wrestle and is he strong?
he's got just like ridiculous power in his hands, like disgusting. Crazy, like, how is it possible for somebody that small to be able to just shatter, you know, fucking cinder blocks with their hands? That's the kind of physical gifts this guy has. I sincerely hope he gets a chance, if only because it'll be so comical because he's so small. Like, he's like generously listed at like 5'4", right?
Mm-hmm.
And there's no way he's 5'4". Like, he's just not. Like, he's maybe 5'2 or 5'3". But, you know, if he could fight it at bantamweight, like, I would love to see that. He really is a tremendously talented guy. It's just you don't see a whole lot of 31-year-old newbies coming into the UFC and having success. It's just not common at that weight class.
Well, you know, at his age, he's got to save his knees. And at featherweight, he doesn't have to bend to get under guys' hips. So there you go. Yeah, and I think it's also worth mentioning that all three guys that Pat mentioned are going to be covered in our extra pieces because I have Burns in my like extra of just the outstanding grapplers that we saw, and I've got a couple guys on there that I'm really excited to talk about, even if not necessarily like they're going to be top 10 guys, because we have a guy like a Chris Fishgold on there who's a really fun technician and is just like crazy aggressive with everything he goes for. He's got a really fun roll under single leg finish that he hits on guys all over the place. And once he hits the mat, he is just constantly working for a submission and always looking to finish people off. Not the best athlete in the world. I mean, still an above average athlete for MMA, but I kind of figure he kind of slots in as kind of like a Joe Lozon type. And have you seen any of him, Pat?
Yeah, I have seen some of him. I think he is not quite his game is just not going to translate real well. I think is the big one. He's certainly talented, but he's just not quite on that level, you know. In terms of his physical ability, he's definitely fun. He's the kind of guy who's gonna. I think he'll end up maybe having a fight or two in a bigger organization, but I think he'll eventually kind of settle in as a regional gatekeeper type. There are a lot of dudes like that on pretty much every regional scene, and I think Fishgold is a notch above most of them, but I don't think that his game will allow him to stick around.
Yeah, and I kind of see him. That the reason I put him on here is because I feel like he's more of like an action fighter prospect than he is like an elite fighter prospect. Like if he hits on all cylinders, he could be like a curtain jerker sort of dude for the UFC who just like gets in there with some guy they think will make for like a fun match, more so than like a guy they're gonna put on like a title track. And then
what's his Ian Entwistle would be like.
Yeah.
Kind of
yeah.
An example of that.
Yeah. And you know, it's one of those things that when we're doing these lists, obviously our top 10 lists are guys that we kind of feel have like the potential to end up being elite fighters. But promotions need guys like that too. You need your Chris Lytles and your guys like that to fill out a card as much as you need the guys on like a serious prospect track. And for the jiu-jitsu guys out there, I have three guys on here who I think are going to get all the jiu-jitsu guys all excited. Because in this division, we have Justin Rader, who is a an ADCC medalist, former wrestler, pretty solid MMA. I don't know how far he's necessarily going to go in this division, but I think it's pretty realistic that he catches on as like a Bellator guy or gets some undercard fights in the UFC, just based on credentials and the fact that he's got a pretty solid ground game. He's hitting like truck rolls to the back in MMA, which you don't see very often. A Damian Maia prodigy in Rafael Domingos, who is just crazy aggressive and a technician on the ground. And then the big name, who I'm really kind of pulling for in some ways because I really look up to his style of grappling, but Ryan Hall, kind of working his way through pro MMA, having a lot of trouble finding opponents. He's had like a terrible run of guys just dropping out of fights either because of injury or not wanting to fight him, but he's got a really kind of deep technical game. He's got better wrestling than you'd expect from a jiu-jitsu guy. He's actually quite adept at getting fights to the floor. His striking is, well, he's working on it. He's working with Firas Sahabi and the guys up at TriStar. And once he hits the ground, he was originally known for like playing like weird inverted guards, but he actually has a pretty nasty top game. He has a couple of knockouts from the top. And one of the reasons he stopped doing competition jiu-jitsu is because one of his real strengths is leg locks. He's got a really deep leg lock game, and most of it was kind of killed by a lot of the rules restricting leg locks. And I think that could make him kind of an X factor to, again, kind of catch on either with a Bellator or something like that if he's able to kind of put a couple fights together.
Yeah, I mean, I think that more or less covers it. The only other guys, I think the other guys drifting around the American scene that we're kind of looking out for would be, like, Shane Burgos, who really only missed out on our list because he's had kind of a dicey medical history, scoliosis, which, I mean, he's had repaired, but, like, guys with spine conditions, that's kind of hard to then, like, turn around and be like, you're going to be a future title contender with your severe spine condition. And Andre Harrison's probably heading for the UFC, I would think, pretty directly. It'll just be a question of when. He fights out of Belmore Kickboxing. He's 7-0. Solid everywhere, not outstanding anywhere, but one of those guys who's just going to get there, almost assuredly. Otherwise, we should talk a little bit about Boston just for a few minutes because we've got a little bit of time. Pat, you've been silent because I'm sure that the weight of our mighty intellect is just weighing down upon you. But was there anybody out of Boston that you came away with thinking, wow, that was an awesome performance from that young prospect?
Not an awesome performance, but I think at this point it's fairly clear that we need to have some respect for Charles Rosa's resiliency and his ability to consistently catch guys and make guys work. You know, he's not going to give you an easy fight, and if you screw up, if you make a mistake, he's going to take advantage of that. Because, you know, that is a fight that Sean Soriano should have won. Like, I don't think there's any way around that. but for whatever reason, Rosa just does not, Soriano just does not seem to make good decisions in fight. And, you know, and there are a lot of guys that it takes them a long time to get to the point where they're comfortable with that. You know, he would not be the first guy to have had an early career replete with just mistakes that in hindsight you're like, how did you do that? Matt Brown did that for years where he would get to the ground and he would panic and he'd think, I got to get up. And he'd leave his neck out there and he'd get you. Like, Matt Brown did that multiple times, you know? But so it's hardly inconceivable that Soriano could become comfortable over time and fix that. He's a good candidate for a promotion like Titan or probably not RFA at this point, but like Titan, maybe Bellator, maybe 1FC, something like that, where he can have some time to work on those things because the talent is obvious in his case. You know, it's clear that like he really could be a good fighter given time. But I think you can't screw around with Charles Rosa. You know, he's dynamic. He's very dynamic on the ground. It doesn't take him much to find a submission. You know, there are still questions about his wrestling game and what exactly he can do on the feet, but on the ground, at least, he's lethal. He's venomous. Yeah.
He's dogged, and he's tough. Like, I mean, and that's one of the things that, like, we were talking about earlier with the UFC, and at a certain point, like, one of the big differences for a lot of it is that almost everybody who gets to this level and really sticks around is just really tough. Just really willing to take a lot of damage and gut through a lot of situations that most guys aren't going to make it through. And, you know, say what you will for Rosa as a, like, his skill set for finding consistent success, but he's got the toughness that's going to see him stay in fights.
Well, yeah, and if he ends up spending more time at ATT's main facility, like, you know, he'll eventually improve those things. He will eventually grow a pair of hands to go along with his kicks, and he will improve his wrestling, because you can't hang out at ATT and not do those things when you're surrounded by guys who are going to eat you alive in a sparring session. If you don't know how to defend a takedown, you're eventually going to learn how to do it.
Yeah, it even looks like his wrestling has probably improved. It was just that his striking is so not there that once it became apparent that he couldn't strike at all, it was really easy to predict his shot in that fight.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think he's a guy who has some talent. Norman Park, I mean, what can you say? You know, the dude, like, I don't think you can beat Gleison Tibau just by volume striking him at this point. Like, you know, if we're talking about Tibau as prospect killer, like, you've got to be able to make him stop and think a little bit. And Park just does not hit anybody hard enough to give them pause, you know?
Yeah. Then this is Park, you know, he's not really a prospect at this point anymore. This was sort of his, like, first trip to the top of the mountain, and he fell short.
Can I say about Park, though, that I forget who it was. I think it was someone on the Sherdog roundtable talked about, I was rather impressed with Park's ability to keep fight off Tibau's takedowns, coming from kind of a pure judo background and things like that. He did a nice job staying on his feet and making Tibau kind of beat him mostly on the feet, and so I think that was at least a sign, like a positive for Park coming out of here, that Tibau wasn't able to work his pick up, put down routine with people where he just picks you up and slams you and picks you up and slams you. So I think that was a positive takeaway for him. But I mean, he just got Tibau'd. I mean, like, it happens to a lot of people. It's like, he's like, what, the winningest lightweight in UFC history?
One of the winningest fighters in UFC history. I think this was his 17th win.
Yeah.
That puts him, like, I think he's tied for second or third all time. Like, he's nuts. But, yeah, I mean, you're absolutely right in that this, you know, better fighters than Norman Park have fallen victim to a T-bowing. Foremost among them, a gentleman who's fighting for a lightweight title here in a couple of months in Rafael Dos Anjos. Dos Anjos got repeatedly taken down by Gleison Tibau, and Dos Anjos is a pretty dang fine wrestler in his own right. Like, this is just a thing that happens sometimes, you know? Like, but I do think it's worrisome that Park really just hasn't shown anything in the way of power at all.
That's a problem, because we knew he had great takedown defense. He's always been a tree stump of a man when it comes to his clinch game, but if he's never going to have power, then he's going to end up in that sort of Michael Bisping territory, except in a much deeper division, where you're like, yeah, he does a lot of things well, but he's never troubling anyone enough to actually put them away, to actually get himself into contention.
I mean, he's also a case in point in, like, the different levels of defensive grappling that you see once you hit the upper levels of the sport. I mean, we're talking about a guy with 20 or 12 of his 20 wins are by submission, and his submission game just disappeared when he hit the UFC. He does not have a single submission win. It's gone. And it's just, you're facing a different level. If your only way to finish fights is kind of like through kind of step-by-step technical chest grappling submission, you're not going to find a lot of those at the higher level of MMA. You're going to need some power in your strikes. You're going to need to open up those submissions if that's your main way of finishing in other ways, to find them consistently. And, I mean, it's not happening for him. So, I mean, if you're gonna be that guy, I mean, you need to be like a fully fleshed out three-dimensional fighter to consistently win decisions in MMA. And you have to have basically no weak points for guys to key in on, and it's even then, it's going to be hard to convince three judges that you've won two out of three rounds every time you go out there.
Yeah, I mean, put slightly differently, I think Park is an interesting example and kind of a salient case in the difference between a plus skill set and an elite skill set. Mm-hmm. Park has a plus top game, like a better than average top game for the division. And you know, when he really settles in, he can drop bombs on you from top position. But think about the difference between that and somebody, to talk about a guy that we mentioned earlier in the broadcast, Mirsad Bektic. Bektic's top game, because of his physical tools and what have you, is just elite. Like, if he gets on top of you, it doesn't matter who you are, Bektic can blast you. If you've got a good defensive guard, you can mostly shut down Park's top game and scramble back to your feet, you know? But that's the difference between elite and plus, that, like, when you get to the very highest levels of MMA, if you have one thing that you want to do, if that's how you want to win a fight, you'd better damn well be able to do it against anybody, you know? And I just don't think that's the case with him. Like, not only are his offensive takedowns not elite, even if he does get you down, he's not going to be able to finish you.
Yeah, I guess the only other thing I want to touch on, and it wasn't really a prospect fight, but it was sort of like a final selling me fight, was for Johnny Case, who I would actually like to see get a pretty decent bump up in difficulty of opponent next time out, because he looks like an amazingly complete fighter. Like, he's at the point where he should be. He's been fighting for like 6 years. I mean, this is the point where if you're going to be there, you're going to be there. But, you know, he was able to absolutely out-wrestle and out-grapple a guy who really only wins fights through his wrestling and grappling. And he looks great. Looks really like he could be a solid top, you know, top third lightweight.
Tell me if you think this is a crazy comparison, but when I was watching that fight, the name that kept coming into my mind was Jorge Masvidal. He reminded me so much of the kind of combination of skill sets that Masvidal has, terms of how well-rounded he is, that he can hurt you pretty much anywhere, he can win a fight in pretty much any phase, but then again, he's not, like, elite at anything, and he can lose a fight in any phase, too. If he were to run up against a guy who were just, like, flat-out better than him at something, he could lose a fight there. But I agree with you. I think he should probably get a guy who's in that top 10 to 20 range in his next out.
I mean, yeah. It was a fun fight, even though it was one-sided, because, I mean, Case won pretty much all, what, like 11 minutes and 54 seconds of that fight, and it was like an A-plus grinder, like, display. He just got in there, and he was just looking to beat Perez up every second he could put hands on him, be it, you know, in the clinch, on the ground, or at range. And it was exactly the kind of, like, it's a high-energy, high-cardio style that just breaks guys down, and you can go a long way with that style. And it looked like a very complete version of that grinder sort of skill set, and I was really impressed by it. I remember watching it and just being like, that's what a young grinder, that's what you want a young grinder to look like when he kind of hits his stride.
Yeah, it's given that we just talked about him and that they're both guys who have spent a lot of time at Alliance, think about the difference between Johnny Case and Norman Park. Like, that there are a lot of similarities in terms of the broad outlines of their skill sets. But Case is a guy who really does have finishing ability in different phases, where Park really, really probably does not. Like, and they think about the added dimension that gives his game.
It's the dynamic speed is what it is. Like, that's really it. It's not, I don't know that Case is stronger than Park, and you know, in fact, I would kind of doubt he is. Doubt it. But his hands and his feet are so much faster. He's so much better at getting in and out of range, at scrambling when he's on the ground, so he's not just locked into a position. He doesn't have to create this established power base before he can strike. You know, he's able to move, and that's what it comes down to, is really just raw speed. Case is a lot faster.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's probably true.
And I mean, anything else? I think we kind of covered everything we wanted to get to. You know, I'm really, really looking forward to this card tomorrow. There are a lot of fighters that I want to see. I don't see one fight on this card that I think is going to be really boring unless Phil Davis beats Ryan Bader.
Yeah, that's. I don't know. I think Henderson Musasi could be both boring and super depressing.
It can be depressing. I hope it's not. I don't know. I mean, I think Musashi. I don't know. I don't know that I have enough faith in Henderson right now to think he'll make that fight boring.
Yeah. Yeah. Who knows? Who knows?
Still, it's a card I'm looking forward to a lot.
Watch Mirsad Bektic, guys. Watch Mirsad Bektic.
Yeah. Watch Mirsad Bektic. Watch Konstantin Arolkin. Watch Albert Tumanov, and you know that I think we're all good. Tom, you've put up a little question. You threw me off my game. I was mid stride. This is like, you know, it's like I'm going after it. I'm right there, and then you're asking me a question, and suddenly all my concentration is gone, and I've got to start all the way over from the beginning.
I pride myself on it.
Okay, did you really have a question?
No, I remember Pat wanted to throw something in for Cage Warriors, didn't he?
Oh, for okay, Ring of Combat, yes.
Oh, sorry, Ring of Combat. God, I'm totally yeah.
Yeah, actually, I think the card's tomorrow night. But this weekend marks the 50th show for the venerable Ring of Combat promotion. I had the chance to speak with the promoter of Ring of Combat, Lou Neglia. I talked to him on Wednesday on Beatdown on Sherdog. Neglia is exactly the kind of character you would expect a Long Island MMA promoter to be. Really a funny guy, a nice guy, really cares deeply about his fighters, knows more about matching up prospects and how to find guys and build them from the very beginnings of their careers than just about anybody out there. They're doing their first show on internet pay-per-view. So if you're into prospects, it's a stacked card. It's got guys like Gregor Gillespie. It's got a kid named Max Bohannon down on the undercard. It's got Julio Arce, who's a big-time prospect coming out of Tiger Schulman's. It's you know, if you're into that sort of thing, I highly recommend it. And Neglia, just a great guy. Just a great guy. I talked to Matt Serra today as he was in the car driving his guys up there, and you know, just it's a really tight scene filled with good guys, and if you're going to spend your money on an internet pay-per-view, buy Ring of Combat.
When you said he's like exactly what you'd imagine a Long Island promoter to be, I really was like connected.
No. In the sense of having just like a really thick accent. And,
yeah, like, no, I hear you.
Yeah, no, I'm not. I make no statements about Lou Neglia like that.
Okay. We don't want to say we know anybody who knows anybody.
Yeah. Well, he
Pat
knows.
Does not want to end up in the river, so he's going to cut it off there.
Like, apparently, his Lou Neglia and Matt Serra's dad have known each other for like 30 years. So, like, so they do know people. They all know each other. So don't talk badly about Lou Neglia, or you'll find a pasta-weight Matt Serra staring at you.
Indeed. All right, on that note, we are well and truly done. Thanks, everyone, for joining us. Give the video a like if you're watching it on YouTube. That shit matters, believe it or not. Follow Patrick Wyman at Patrick_Wyman and on SureDog.com. Follow Tom Grant at TP_Grant and myself at DZane Simon. You can find both Tom and I at Bloody Elbow. And tune in next week, because we'll be back, I'm pretty sure, unless one of us gets whacked.